Although he had substantially moderated his strident criticism since, he'd made no secret of his original opposition to the decision to defy the Group of Four's authority. Charlien was less surprised about that than some had been. For all his ostentatious devotion to the Church, and whatever else she thought of him, no one could dispute the fact that he'd always given generously to the Church, it was readily apparent to her that he'd never even made a gesture towards applying the writ's admonitions of brotherhood to his own hapless employees, nor was there any evidence of any particular righteousness in his own life. In fact, in her opinion, he'd been a perfect fit for the Group of Four. His gifts to the Church, like his highly public lip service to the Church's teachings, had represented an attempt to bribe God, not any sort of genuine, heart-deep piety. Which meant the Church of Caris represented a challenge to the swindle he'd spent his life perpetrating upon God and the archangels. "Charlie, you just might be being a little harder on him than he deserves," she reminded herself. "Maybe I am," herself replied. "Then again, maybe I'm not." Despite his efforts to downplay his original opposition to Caris's rejection of the Group of Four, Kyrie remained at best only imperfectly resigned to the existence of the Church of Caris. He'd embraced at least the form of the Church's reformation in Caris, but Charlien was one of those who doubted that his heart was truly in it. The war against the Church was simply producing too many contracts worth too much money for him to stand on principle and let all those lovely marks fall into someone else's cash box. That would have been more than enough to prejudice Charlien against him, but he hadn't stopped there. Her uncle, the Duke of Halbrook Hollow, was one of the 20 or so wealthiest men in the Kingdom of Chisholm, and Kyrie had spent the last couple of months enticing him into investing in Kyrie's various Carisian business enterprises. It wasn't that Charlien resented her uncle's involvement in Carisian ventures, but if he was going to invest with anyone, why couldn't it have been with someone like Hausman or Mikhail? Someone who was at least remotely principled. "He's preying on Uncle Bertram's principles," she thought resentfully. "He knows how unhappy Uncle Bertram is with my decisions, and he's using his own reputation for dedication to the Church to convince Uncle Bertram to pour money into his pocket. By now, Uncle Bertram is convinced Kyrie is actually his friend, one of the very few friends he has here in Caris. And the last thing I need is for the uncle, whose loyalty to the Church of Caris is already questionable, to be publicly spending time with someone with Kyrie's reputation." She closed her eyes for a moment, scolding herself yet again. Her uncle could scarcely be blamed for associating with one of the handful of Carisians of rank or wealth who didn't eye him with open suspicion. And although she'd dropped a few hints to Halbrook Hollow, she couldn't bring herself to be any more explicit in her efforts to drive a wedge between him and Kyrie. She ought to. She knew she ought to. But he had so few friends in Caris, and she was the one who had compelled him to come here. However much she might detest Kyrie, he obviously saw the man in quite another light. "And it's always possible your view of Kyrie is distorted specifically because you resent Uncle Bertram's relationship with him," she told herself. "I would be considerably happier myself if Kyrie were far, far away from not just the Imperial Parliament, but from the House of Commons as well," Archbishop Michael admitted. "On the other hand, perhaps it's as well to have him where he is."
"And why might that be, Michael?" Grey Harbour asked tartly.
aside, of course, from the convenience of always knowing where he is when it's time for the headsman. Because, Regis, Stainer said, he's not unique. He's far more irritating than many, more visible than most, and almost certainly more hypocritical than anyone else I can think of right offhand. But not unique. There are many others here in Caris and in Chisholm who undoubtedly feel the same way he does. He didn't even glance in her direction, Charlian noted, remembering another conversation with him. It's important that those who do not agree with the Church of Caris not be deprived of their own right to a public voice, the Archbishop said. This is a struggle over principles, over the right and responsibility of individuals to make choices, and, as Caleb said, we cannot win a war for freedom of conscience if we deny freedom of conscience to those who simply happen to disagree with us. If that means we must put up with a few Kyries, even in Parliament, then that's a price we must be willing to pay. In theory, I agree, Greyharbor said. And God knows I've spent enough time in politics to realize that genuinely trying to listen to opposing viewpoints is always messy. But Kyrie... He shook his head, his expression one of disgust. Why couldn't the Temple Loyalists at least have chosen themselves a spokesman who had an ounce of genuine principle somewhere in his bones? I suppose it's a case of settling for what they can find, Charlian said tartly. Then she shook herself. But that's enough about Master Kyrie, she continued. We have far more important things to worry about. Like exactly when the delegates should spontaneously invite me to address them. Your Majesty, Greyharbor said. That sounds extraordinarily calculating and cynical, especially for someone of your own tender years. Not calculating and cynical, my lord, just practical, she replied. And my question stands. When should we arrange to have the invitation extended? There's no need to move too quickly, Your Majesty, Stainer said. My own advice would be to give all of them at least a few more days to stew in their own juices. Let us hammer our rough edges off a bit, and give us time to begin shaking down into recognizable factions before you come in and use your own mallet on us. Wait until I've got recognizable targets, you mean? Something like that, yes. You don't think it would be a better idea for me to get in a few blows while everything is still more or less in a state of flux? Charlian's tone wasn't argumentative. She was simply an expert tactician discussing tactics with her fellow experts. Your Majesty, whatever you might do immediately isn't going to keep factions from forming, Stainer pointed out. That's simple human nature. I'm of the opinion that it would be wiser to allow water to seek its own level, to let the factions form naturally, so that we can identify both friends and foes before we draw our swords. My, what a martial metaphor, Greyharbor murmured. Stainer quirked an eyebrow at him, and the First Counselor laughed. I'm not disagreeing with you, Michael. In fact, I think you're right. I believe I do, too, Charlian said thoughtfully. Good, Greyharbor said. In that case, I'll have a word with Sharphill. He's already primed to start the ball rolling by, as you said, Your Majesty, spontaneously moving that the delegates entreat you to address them. All he needs is a nod. Fine. Charlian smiled. Sir Michael Trevier, the Earl of Sharphill, was Edward Houseman's father-in-law. He also had sufficient seniority in the Carisian peerage to ensure a hearing even from a Chisomian noble, and he was very carefully keeping his head down and giving as little indication as possible of his own thoughts at the moment. Charlene had liked Sir Michael from the moment she met him, and she could readily understand why Hausmann thought as highly as he did of his wife's father. "Well," she said, picking up her wine glass once again, "I have to say, gentlemen, that I'm feeling considerably more cheerful than I was this morning. Whatever else happens, at least Caleb and I seem to have allies in most of the necessary places."
"Allies, Your Majesty?" Grey Harbor repeated innocently. "Don't you actually mean spies, provocateurs, and saboteurs?"
"My lord," Charlian said in shocked tones, "I cannot believe that a royal counselor of your many years of experience could possibly be guilty of dabbling in candor at a moment like this. What were you thinking?"
"Forgive me, Your Majesty," he said earnestly. "It was only a temporary lapse. I don't know what came over me, but I promise I'll do my best to refrain from such unseemly outbursts in the future."
"I should certainly hope so," Empress Charlian of Caris said primly.
5. Galleon Wing, off East Island, League of Coruscant.
"Your Highness, I think you'd better go below," Captain Harris said quietly.
Princess Iris opened her mouth, prepared to protest, then closed it again, protest unspoken, and glanced at the Earl of Corus. It wasn't an unspoken appeal for him to override the captain. It came close, but it stopped short, and Corus felt a fresh surge of pride in her, as, almost against his will, he found himself once again comparing her to the older of her two brothers.
"If you think best, Captain," she said to Harris after a moment. "Do you think I need to go below immediately, or can I watch for a few more minutes?"
"I'd really feel more comfortable," Captain Harris began, turning to the princess, then paused in mid-sentence.
It was her eyes, Corus thought with a half-hidden smile, despite the very real potential danger of the moment. They met the captain's steadily, levelly, and in the end, Corus decided, it was the fact that, look into those eyes as he might, Harris saw neither fear nor petulance, but did see a promise to accept his decree, whatever it might be.
"I'd really feel more comfortable if you went below now," the captain continued his interrupted thought. "On the other hand, I don't suppose it would hurt if you stayed a little longer, Your Highness. I would appreciate it, however, if you would take His Highness below in time to get him thoroughly settled in case we should have visitors."
"Of course, Captain," Iris smiled at him.
There was no doubt that she understood exactly what he'd been implying, but those eyes of her dead mother met his unflinchingly, and Joel Harris found himself smiling in approval.
"I'll tell you when it's time to go, Your Highness," he told her, then bowed ever so slightly, as if he thought watching spyglasses might detect a more profound gesture of respect, and turned away to shade his eyes with one hand and peer across the sun-struck water at the low-slung, kraken-like schooner, slicing steadily nearer. Iris stepped a bit closer to Corus, without ever taking her own eyes from the Carisian warship. The Earl didn't think it was a conscious action on her part, although he was sorely tempted to put an encouraging arm around her straight, slender shoulders. Instead, he simply stood there, watching with her, and hoping for the best. He found himself wishing they'd been aboard Harris's cutlass instead of wing. The thought of being able to meet the Carisian ship's firepower on an even footing was incredibly attractive at the moment. But there'd never been any hope of getting Cutlass or one of her sisters past the blockaders watching Manchir, of course. And since it had been impossible to use a proper warship, Tartarian and Harris had undoubtedly been correct in their argument that putting additional marines aboard wing,
or trying to fit extra guns into her somewhere would have been a serious mistake. Their best hope had been to avoid Carizian cruisers entirely. Failing that, their only hope was to appear as innocent and unexceptional as possible. The last thing they could afford was to attempt to explain to one of the heavily gunned Carizian schooners why they had 20 or 30 Coruscantian marines on board a merchant galleon flying the colors of Harchong. To that end, Wing's seamen wore the motley assortment of garments one might have expected to find aboard a merchant ship whose owners were too tight-fisted to provide a well-stocked slop chest. The men wearing those garments, however, had been carefully selected by Captain Harris and Earl Tartarian as much for their years of experience in the merchant service as for their demonstrated loyalty and intelligence during their naval service. They knew exactly how a merchant crew ought to be acting under these circumstances. Now Corus kept his eyes on the Carizian and hoped that Harris and Tartarian had been right. Joel Harris stood on Wing's aftercastle, watching the Carizian maneuver. The galleon's aftercastle was much lower than it would have been aboard a warship, and Harris concentrated on looking as calm as he could. It wouldn't have done to look too calm, of course. Any merchant skipper facing a potential naval boarding party would feel plenty of natural apprehension, after all.
"Which I bloody well do," he told himself. "The trick is to look nervous enough without looking so nervous they decide I have to be hiding something."
In fact, he was discovering that his belly had been less tightly knotted at Darko Sound, when he'd realized what the Carizian guns could actually do, than it was now. The princess and her younger brother had gone below without protest, settling into their cramped cabin. Wing had never been intended to transport passengers in luxury, and, in keeping with all the rest of their disguise, Princess Iris and Prince Divan had been assigned quarters which were relatively comfortable, but downright Spartan. They and the Earl of Corus were all covered with false identities in Wing's log, but everyone would be much happier if the Carizians never paid any attention at all to the plainly dressed daughter and son of a merchant factor. The Carizian was sliding easily downwind towards him, her guns run out, and he could see her captain standing on his own quarter-deck, gazing at Wing through a spyglass. He hoped the Carizian was taking note of the fact that not a single one of Wing's seamen was anywhere near the galleon's pathetic broadside of falcons. Nor had any of the ship's wolves been mounted on their swivels.
"We're absolutely no threat at all," he thought very hard in the other captain's direction. "Just another scruffy little merchant ship with a cargo for Shui."
The schooner came still closer, till it was less than 50 yards off Wing's windward side as the galleon broad-reached on the starboard tack. The Carizian cruiser loped along, easily matching Wing's best speed under these wind conditions, with only her own foresail and headsail set, and Harris felt an abrupt stab of envy. Excited as he'd been to receive command of Cutlass, he knew the galleon could never have matched the speed and agility of that schooner, and the Carizian's broadside of 30-pounder carronades was almost as heavy as Cutlass's new broadside.
"And I bet they're not assigning the damned schooners to just anybody," he thought grimly. "They'll want men who can think as well as fight in command."
"Ahoy, Wing!"
The Carizian captain's voice floated across the water between the two ships, amplified and directed by his leather speaking trumpet.
"And what can I do for you this fine morning?"
Harris bawled back through his own speaking trumpet.
"Heave to, if you please," the Carizian replied.
"On whose authority?"
Harris tried hard to put the right note of bluster into the question.
You know whose authority, Captain?
The Carisian's voice sounded more amused than anything else, Harris noticed, and he used his speaking trumpet to gesture in the direction of the Kraken banner flying above his own ship.
This is an Imperial merchant ship, Harris shot back.
And we're not at war with the Empire, the Carisian told him. But we are at war with people who might pretend to be Ha-Chongis. Now heave to, Captain, before I start to think you might be one of them.
Harris waited a few moments longer, then allowed his shoulders to slump.
All right, he growled back in a frustrated tone, and turned to his first officer. Heave to, he said.
Yes, sir.
Harris frowned, but the other officer had caught himself before he gave the formal naval acknowledgement of an order, and he'd managed not to salute either. Which, given the fact that men tended to respond the way they'd been trained to under pressure, and that he had to be feeling just as anxious as Harris did, was probably about the best Harris could have expected. Wing hove to without the snap or efficiency one might have anticipated out of a warship. Her big courses were brailed up, her spritsail disappeared, and her fore topsail and main topsail were braced around, trying to drive her in opposite directions and holding her almost motionless under their opposed forces. The schooner matched her maneuver much more smartly, and a launch was dropped over her side and manned. It rowed swiftly across the gap between the two vessels and came alongside Wing.
Permission to come aboard, sir?
The youthful lieutenant in command of the boarding party asked, respectfully enough, as he climbed the galleon's side to the entry port. Harris allowed himself to glower at the young man for a second or two, then grimaced.
Since you've seen fit to invite yourself, I suppose you might as well, he growled.
Thank you, sir, the lieutenant said.
He climbed the rest of the way through the entry port and waited while 10 Carisian Marines followed him aboard.
My captain instructed me to apologize for the inconvenience, Captain, he said then. He realizes that no one ever likes to be stopped and boarded by a foreign navy. If you'll show me your papers, we'll try to get this over with as quickly as possible.
That'll suit me just fine. Harris replied. Come with me.
Thank you, sir.
The lieutenant nodded to the sergeant commanding the squad of Marines. One of them attached himself to the lieutenant. The others stayed where they were, just inside the entry port. They made no overtly threatening gestures, although neither Harris nor any of his men doubted that the muskets grounded unthreateningly on the deck were loaded. The lieutenant and his single accompanying Marine followed Harris into his cabin under the aftercastle. They paused just inside the door and waited patiently while Harris rummaged about in a desk drawer for Wing's papers. He took a few minutes to find them, then hauled them out, along with the carefully prepared log, and passed them across to the lieutenant.
Thank you, sir, the Carisian said again.
He stepped a little farther into the cabin, holding the ship's papers under the light coming through the cabin skylight, and examined them closely. He clearly knew what he was looking for, and Harris was abruptly grateful that the men who'd forged those papers had known what they were about, too. The lieutenant set the papers aside after a moment, then flipped quickly through the log. He didn't try to read the entire thing, but it was obvious he was looking for any discrepancies or any sign that newer entries had been made among the older ones.
Thank Langhorne we made it up from scratch, Harris thought from behind his calm expression. Even if I did think I was going to die of writer's cramp before we finished the damn thing.
Most of the entries were in his own hand, although he'd used several different pens and inks. Other entries, scattered throughout, were in the handwriting of his first and second officers, and Earl Corus's forgers had aged the pages nicely. A couple of entries had been so water-damaged as to be almost illegible, and most were the sort of curt one- or two-line entries one might have expected from a merchant skipper, while a few had been expanded into larger descriptions of specific events.
"Could I ask what you're doing in these waters, Captain?" the lieutenant asked finally, looking up from the log and neatly gathering up Wing's registration, customs, and ownership papers once more.
"Sailing to Shui Bay, just like the log says," Harris replied a bit tartly.
"But why this way?"
The lieutenant's tone was still polite, but his eyes had narrowed.
"According to these, you sailed from Karis. Wouldn't it have been a considerably shorter voyage going west, not east?"
"I'm sure it would have," Harris acknowledged. "On the other hand, the waters off the southern coasts of Haven and Howard are swarming with privateers these days. Or hadn't you heard, Lieutenant?"
"I believe I have heard something about that, yes, sir."
The lieutenant's lips twitched, and Harris snorted.
"I'm sure you have. Any road, it seemed to me I'd be less likely to run into a privateer going east, since all of them seemed to be hunting westward from Karis. And it also seemed to me, no disrespect, Lieutenant, that every so often a privateer's likely to get a mite over-enthusiastic, if you take my meaning. I'd just as soon avoid situations where something unfortunate might happen. The owners wouldn't like it if something did."
"I see." The lieutenant gazed at him for several seconds, eyes thoughtful. Then he shrugged. "I imagine that makes sense, as long as the length of your passage doesn't matter too much."
Harris snorted again.
"It's not going to bother a cargo of farming gear a lot if it takes a few extra days, or even a few extra 5 days to arrive, Lieutenant. It's not like I was hauling a cargo of perishables."
"Farming gear?"
"Reapers, cultivators, and harrows," Harris said tersely. "We loaded it in Telisburg."
"May I examine it?"
"Why not?"
Harris flipped both hands in a gesture which combined exasperation and acceptance.
"Follow me."
He led the lieutenant back out on deck and beckoned to the naval lieutenant who'd been assigned the role of Wing's purser.
"He wants to see the cargo," he said. "Show him."
"Yes, sir," the purser acknowledged, and looked sourly at the Carisian.
"Try not to leave too big a mess for me to clean up," he said.
"I'll try," the Carisian agreed sardonically. Four of Wing's seamen knocked out the wedges and lifted the battens from the main hatch cover, and four of the Carisian marines clambered down into the hold, where they found exactly what the manifest said they ought to have found. The farm equipment had come from one of Edward Hausman's manufactories, although it hadn't been bought in Telisburg. In fact, it had been purchased in Chisholm and had been bound for the Duchy of West Wind when the first tide of Carisian privateers had swept across the waters around Zebediah and Coruscant, and Wing had taken refuge at Elvarth. It was still in its original crates, however, and those crates bore the customs marks of Telisburg. They didn't bear Chisholmian custom marks, however, since they'd somehow evaded Chisholm's customs inspection. Queen Charlian had formally prohibited trade between Chisholm and Coruscant even before she sailed to Telisburg. Unfortunately, at least some of her subjects, especially those who'd already accepted orders from Coruscantian customers, had decided she surely couldn't have meant her prohibition to apply to them, and had taken steps to see to it that it didn't. That had been the final decisive factor in Earl Tartarian's choice of Wing for her present mission. After all, few things could possibly have looked less threatening or less suspicious to a Carisian boarding party than goods manufactured in Karis itself. The marines clambered around in the hold for several minutes, then climbed back on deck.
"Matches the manifest, sir," the senior marine told his lieutenant, and the lieutenant turned back to Harris.
Well, he said, handing Wing's papers back over. I suppose that's that, Captain. Thank you for your cooperation, and once again, please accept my captain's apologies for inconveniencing you.
No harm done, I suppose, Harris allowed, just a bit grudgingly.
Then he shook his head and grimaced.
Truth to tell, Lieutenant, I don't blame you or your captain. Mind you, I think all of you Carizians have lost your minds, but under the circumstances, I probably have done the same thing in your boots.
I'm glad you understand, sir. The lieutenant bowed slightly, then twitched his head at his marines. The sergeant came briefly to attention, and then started chivying his men back down into the launch.
I hope you and your ship enjoy a safe voyage to Shui Bay, Captain, the lieutenant said, then followed his marines.
Harris stood at the bulwark, watching as the launch's oars dipped, then pulled strongly back towards the schooner. A part of him felt almost sorry for the lieutenant, but the truth was that the young man had done his job well. He'd looked in exactly the right places, and he'd found exactly the right documents and cargo. And who in his right mind would have suspected such an elaborate ruse designed solely to get three passengers to Shui Bay? The very idea was preposterous.
Of course, I suppose the question of just how preposterous it is depends on who the passengers are, doesn't it?
Joel Harris smiled wolfishly at the thought, and discovered that, for the first time, he was perfectly content to be commanding Wing instead of Cutlass. 6. Archbishop's Palace, Tellisburg, Empire of Karras.
Your Eminence, Father Bryan said, Madame Dinis is here.
Of course, Bryan.
Archbishop Michael rose and walked around his desk, smiling broadly, as Usher bowed Adderai Dinis through his office door. He extended his hand, and Arake Dinis's widow returned his smile warmly as she took it. He'd come to know her far better in the months since her arrival in Tellisburg, and he wasn't surprised when she rose on tiptoe and kissed him lightly on the cheek.
Thank you for agreeing to see me, Your Eminence, she said, as he tucked her hand into his elbow and escorted her across to one of the office's chairs. I realize it isn't easy to fit someone into your schedule on such short notice, especially not with all the details of the new parliament still being settled.
She had not, Stainer noticed, added all the details of the merger with that other batch of heretics in Chisholm to her list of his duties. That was tactful of her.
Fitting you into my schedule is never a problem, he told her. Well, sometimes it can be a bit difficult, I suppose, but it's never an unwelcome difficulty.
Thank you, she said,
and he considered her carefully, if unobtrusively. The lines worry and grief had carved in her face were less prominent than they had been. They would never fade entirely, just as he suspected that the occasional flashes of sorrow in her eyes would never entirely go away. Yet she'd settled into her new life in Tellisburg better than he would have been prepared to predict. It was possible that Caleb and Charlian's decision to house her in the palace and make her an official member of their own household had something to do with that, but Stainer thought it had more to do with the fact that, for the first time in her life, she could openly oppose the corrupt system which had ensnared her husband. She'd become one of the most vocal and effective supporters of the Church of Karras's rejection of the present church's leader's corruption. That made her anathema to the Carizian temple loyalists, of course, but the Church of Karras's supporters, already disposed to welcome her after they learned the details of Archbishop Arake's hideous death, had taken her to their hearts in her own right, and Charlian had assigned her two personal armsmen as a precaution.
To what do I owe the pleasure of this particular visit? He asked now.
Actually, Your Eminence, I need your advice. I...
She broke off as Arden poked his sleek, round, earless head up out of his basket. Adderai Dinnis was one of the cat lizard's favorite people. She could always be relied upon to allow him to extort endless petting from her, and he hopped up and ambled across the office floor to leap up into her chair with a hum of welcome.
Well, Stainer thought, I suppose it could be welcome. Personally, I think it's triumph.
The cat lizard settled down across her lap, and she stroked his short, luxuriant coat with a smile.
You do realize, don't you, that the sole value human beings have for cat lizards is the fact that they have hands? Stainer asked.
Nonsense, Your Eminence. They also have pitchers of milk.
Well, yes, I suppose there is that as well, Stainer allowed with a smile.
Then, as Adderai sat back, still stroking the cat lizard, he cocked his head.
I believe that before we were interrupted, you were about to explain why you might desire my advice.
Yes.
Her fingers never stopped moving, but her expression faded into one of intense seriousness.
Actually, need your advice probably wasn't the best way to put it, but I do need your spiritual counsel, I think.
Of course, he murmured,
his eyes darkening with concern as he absorbed her expression and the tone of her voice.
I have a letter for you, Your Eminence, one I've been instructed to share with you and with the Emperor. It's from a very dear friend of mine, and my friend has made an offer which could be of great value to Garrus. But if that offer is accepted, it could also be very dangerous for my friend. So I've come to you to bring you the letter and also to ask your advice. You're not only a member of the Imperial Council, but a priest. My friend has already risked a great deal in a great many ways. I'm hesitant to let still more risk be added to that, yet I'm not sure I have the right to make this decision for someone else. So before I pass that offer on to Empress Sharlion, I want to tell you a little bit about this letter, the reason it was written, and what it implies.
And ask my opinion on whether or not you should allow your friend to run the additional risk to which you've just referred, he asked gently.
Yes.
She looked into his eyes.
Politically, I know what your answer ought to be, Your Eminence. But I've also come to know you as one of God's priests. I ask you to consider this matter as a priest.
Always, he told her simply, and she inhaled in what might have been relief.
She sat for a few more seconds, petting Arden, then shook herself.
Your Eminence, when I first arrived here in Telesburg, you and the Emperor and Empress all expressed your relief and surprise that I'd managed it. Well, I wouldn't have without the help of a dear friend. Let me tell you about her. Ninian's father was Grand Vicar Joel, who, as you may be aware, was my uncle. Unfortunately, her mother died 2 years after she was born, and my uncle, who I'm sure must have had some worthwhile qualities, beyond his truly outstanding gifts for hypocrisy and selfishness, and an undeniable skill at manipulating temple politics, although I never personally saw them, you understand, was unwilling to acknowledge his bastard daughter.
Adderai's lips tightened in remembered anger, and her eyes were hard.
Fortunately, Uncle Joel hadn't become Grand Vicar yet. He was only a vicar at the time, as was my father. Father and mother were sufficiently angry at him not to allow a mere vicar's resentment to keep them from taking her in, and until she was 12 years old, she was raised in my parents' home. They called her Ninian because she was such a beautiful baby, and she grew up to be as beautiful as the original Ninian. For all intents and purposes, she was my sister, not simply my cousin, although not even father and mother were prepared to openly acknowledge her blood relationship to us. There were appearances to be maintained, after all. Then her father was elected to the Grand Vicarate, and everything changed. He insisted my parents send Ninian away, and this time they felt they had no choice but to agree. So they sent her off to convent school to be educated. I think they hoped she might discover a vocation, which would keep her safely out of my uncle's sight. And I suppose, in a way, she did.
This time, Adderai's lips twitched in what was obviously amusement.
I'm sure a bedardist like yourself would have a field day, deciding exactly why she chose the particular vocation she did. And I don't doubt that the circumstances of her own birth played a part. But I genuinely don't think she did it simply because she could be certain it would keep her father spinning in his grave for centuries. At any rate, what she did was to change her name and... And that's how Angelic came to be able to help me and the boys escape to Karis,
Adderai finished some time later.
She has all manner of contacts, and one of them managed to smuggle us aboard ship without any of the Schulerites looking for us realizing who we were.
She sounds like a rather amazing woman, Stainer said. I wish I could have the opportunity of meeting her some day.
Do you really mean that, Your Eminence?
Adderai asked, her eyes searching his face, and he nodded.
If you're asking me if I would condemn her for her choice of vocation, I believe you called it, the answer is no, he replied serenely. I won't say it's exactly the one I would have wished for my own daughter. But then again, my daughter never had to fend for herself simply because she would have been an embarrassment to my high and holy position. And from all you've told me about her, she obviously managed to become a strong person and a loyal and loving friend and sister, despite her father's manifold shortcomings.
Yes, Adderai said softly. Yes, she did. Although I must confess that both of us felt more than a little odd over her relationship with Erake.
I scarcely see how you could have felt any other way, Adderai.
Stainer shook his head.
The lives we live are not always the ones we might have chosen. But with two such extraordinary women in his life, I begin to see that there must always have been rather more to Erake Dinis than I realized at the time. Enough more that perhaps we should not all have been so surprised at the final decision of his life.
I don't really know about that, Your Eminence. I'd like to believe you were right, and perhaps I do. But at the moment, the point is that Angelic, Ninian, has sent me this.
She set Arden aside and reached into the handbag she'd brought with her. Arden obviously felt intensely annoyed by her misguided interruption of the proper relationship between human fingers and cat lizard fur. He gave her one disgusted look, then hopped down to the floor and headed back to his basket and his interrupted nap. Adderai paid him no attention as she extracted a thick envelope and set it squarely in her lap, where the indignant cat lizard had been, and looked down at it for a long moment.
Your Eminence, this is a transcript of the Grand Vicar's address from the throne, she said, looking up. It's a transcript of the actual address, not the expurgated version that was officially circulated.
Stainer stiffened, sitting upright in his chair, and she nodded.
I realize the official address was severe enough in its charges and allegations against Karis, Your Eminence. It turns out the actual address was worse. I suspect the reason it was edited before it was officially released is its explicit warning to the Vicarate that the group of four... Oh, excuse me, I meant the Grand Vicar, of course, has decided holy war is inevitable.
Stainer inhaled deeply. not in surprise so much as in confirmation.
I was very tempted to burn her letter and simply hand the transcript to you and to Empress Charlian without telling you where it came from or exactly how it came into my hands,
Adderai continued.
To protect Ninian's identity?
No, Your Eminence, to prevent you from ever reading what else she's offered to do.
Stainer simply cocked his head, raising his eyebrows slightly and waiting, and she sighed.
Your Eminence, she's offered, essentially, to become your spy in Zion. And she's offered, in fact she sent with this letter, the contents of her own files.
Her files?
Almost 20 years of meticulous notes detailing abuses of church authority, corruption in the ranks of the vicarate, the sale of writs of attestation and of condemnation under the proscriptions, the buying and selling of legal decisions like the one in favor of Taddeo Montale's claim to Hanth, all of it. They fill several trunks, Your Eminence. It's amazing what powerful men will discuss among themselves or let slip in the company of someone in her profession.
Stainer's eyes widened. For several moments he only sat there, looking at her, before he spoke again.
That's an extraordinary offer.
She's an extraordinary woman, Your Eminence,
Adderai said simply.
I can well believe that, from what you've already told me. Still, I must confess that I'm puzzled.
About the reason for her offer to act as the Church of Corus's spy? Or about the reason she compiled those notes in the first place?
Both, actually.
Your Eminence, Ninian has never had a great deal of reason to feel any loyalty to the great church dynasties. To individuals from those dynasties, like me, and like my parents, perhaps, but not to the dynasties themselves. And even if she'd had any such reason, her first and strongest reaction is to sympathize with those the church has abandoned, much as my uncle abandoned her. Worse, from the perspective of the vicarate at least, that convent education of hers took. She believes, as I do, in what the church is supposed to stand for, and that makes her opposition to what the church actually is inevitable. And
she looked directly into Stainer's eyes once more.
I have to confess that it was Ninian who first drew me into active opposition to the internal corruption of Mother Church, not the other way around.
But I'm still somewhat at a loss to understand why she collected all of the information you've described.
I realize that, and although she didn't actually authorize me to tell you this, I'm going to have to give you some additional information if I'm really going to explain. Before I do, though, please understand that what I'm about to tell you could cost scores of lives, if Clinton should ever learn of it, Your Eminence.
You intend to tell me this in order to clarify why you would like my advice on passing her offer along to Charlian?
Stainer asked, and she nodded.
In that case, Adderai, it comes under the seal of the confessional. Without your permission, I will never share it with another living soul.
Thank you, Your Eminence.
She drew another deep breath and squared her shoulders.
Your Eminence, there is, within the church, at the very highest levels, a group of men who are as aware of the abuses around them as any Corisian could be. I won't reveal their names, even to you, without their permission. For that matter, I feel confident that I know only a handful of them. But Angelic, Ninian, has been one of their primary agents for decades. They call themselves simply the Circle, and their purpose is...
7. Talbor Pass, Duchy of Manchir, League of Coruscant. Sir Corin Garvey watched grimly as the wounded limped towards the rear. Many of them used their weapons as improvised crutches. Here and there, one of them leaned on the shoulder of a companion. Sometimes both were wounded and leaned together, supporting one another, and stretcher parties carried men too severely wounded even to hobble. There could be nothing in the world more terrible than a battle lost, he thought. It wasn't simply the defeat. It was knowing that so many men had died and been wounded under his orders for absolutely nothing. Unlike many commanders, Garvey made it a point to visit the wounded as often as he could. Altogether too many of them were going to die anyway, despite everything the Order of Pasquale could do, and he owed it to them to at least tell them how grateful he was for all they'd done and suffered. And it also kept him aware of the price of his failure.
"That's not really fair, Corin," a corner of his brain insisted. "It's not your fault the Carisians have longer-ranged artillery and those damnable rifles."
"No," another corner of his brain replied harshly.
"But it is your fault you managed to get your entire army penned up in Talbot Pass like sheep in a slaughter pen."
His jaw clenched, and remembered fury guttered through his veins. The one thing he'd managed to do since that disastrous afternoon, which gave him a fierce sense of personal satisfaction, was to relieve Baron Barkor of his command. Yet even that sense of satisfaction was flawed, because he couldn't forgive himself for not going ahead and relieving Barkor the instant word of Caleb's landing had reached him. The Baron had taken over 4 hours to get any of his troops into motion. Even then, he'd moved with arthritic slowness, and the main body of the rear guard had still been inside the western terminus of the pass when the defeated remnants of Winshare's cavalry had come pelting back. There'd still been time, even then, for Barkor to clear the pass and at least let some of the other troops trapped behind him get clear of Talbor's restrictive terrain. But the Baron had panicked as he heard the defeated cavalry's inevitably inflated estimates of the Carisian's strength. On his own initiative, he'd suspended the advance and ordered his men to dig in where they were. By the time Garvey had managed to reach the rear guard to personally countermand Barkor's orders, the Carisians truly had been present in strength, and the attempt to fight his way out of the pass had ended in bloody wreckage and the loss of over 3,000 in dead, wounded, and prisoners. Coupled to the losses Winshare's cavalry had taken, that had amounted to a total loss of over 6,000. And they'd actually ended up being driven the better part of a mile and a half farther east, deeper into the pass. That had been 2.5 5 days ago. Over the last 12 days, he'd launched 5 separate attempts to cut his way out, better than doubling his original casualties in the process. He'd known the effort was almost certainly futile, and so had his men. Yet they'd responded to his orders with a stolid courage and a willingness to try anyway, which had made him ashamed to ask it of them.
"But it's not as if you had a choice, Corin. With your supply line cut, you can't just stay here. There's no more waiting game when you've already had to start slaughtering horses and dragons. And even on short rations, supplies are going to run out in days, not 5 days. It's either fight your way out, starve, or surrender."
His mind flinched away from the last word, yet it was one he had to face. Even if Coruscant had possessed another field army, it couldn't have broken through the Carisian lines to relieve him. Not against Carisian weapons, and not, he admitted harshly, against Carisian commanders. Food was in short supply, and the healers were running out of bandages and medicines. They were already out of almost all painkillers, and his men were suffering and dying for nothing, accomplishing nothing, except to force the Carisians to expend ammunition, killing them. his fists clenched at his side. Then he drew a deep, decisive breath. "General Garvai," Caleb Armok said quietly, as the Coruscantian commander was shown into his tent.
"Your Majesty."
Caleb stood with Merlin at his back and watched Garvai straighten from his respectful bow. The Coruscantian had taken pains with his appearance, the Emperor noted. He was freshly shaved, his clothing clean and pressed, but there was a tightness around his eyes. His face was gaunt, and that immaculate clothing seemed to hang loosely on his frame. Caleb knew from Merlin's reports that Garvai had insisted that his officers' rations, including his own, be cut along with those of his private soldiers, and it showed.
"I thank you for agreeing to meet with me and for granting me safe conduct through your lines, Your Majesty."
Garvai sounded stiff, almost stilted in his formality.
"General," Caleb said, "I don't enjoy killing men, and I especially don't enjoy killing brave men who, through no fault of their own, can't even fight back effectively. If anything we say or do here today can keep some of those men alive, I'll count this meeting as time well spent."
Garvai looked into the Emperor's face, and his own expression seemed to relax just a bit. Caleb saw it, and wondered how much of Garvai's tension had been due to the stories which had been told, and grown in the telling, of his ultimatum to Earl Thirsk after the Battle of Crag Reach.
"Since you've said that, Your Majesty, I suppose there isn't any point in attempting to pretend my army is in anything but desperate straits. I can continue to hold out for some days longer, and the men under my command will attack yet again if I ask it of them. But you and I both know that, in the end, any further attacks will accomplish nothing. If I believed continued resistance could serve my prince or Coruscant, then resist I would. Under the circumstances which actually obtain, I must ask for the terms upon which you would permit my men to honorably surrender."
"I can't say your request was unanticipated, Sir Corin." Caleb's tone was almost compassionate. "And my terms are relatively simple. I will require your men to surrender their weapons. I will require the surrender of all of your army's artillery, baggage train, and surviving draft animals. Officers will be permitted to retain their swords, and any man, officer or trooper, who can demonstrate personal ownership of his horse will be allowed to retain it. I regret that I can't parole your officers or any of your men," the Emperor continued. Garvai's eyes narrowed, his jaw muscles tightening, but Caleb went on calmly. "Under any other circumstances, I would gladly accept your parole, Sir Corin. While we may have found ourselves enemies, I would never question or doubt your honesty or your honor. Unfortunately, as you may perhaps have heard," Caleb's tight smile bared his teeth, "the Empress and I have been formally excommunicated by Grand Vicar Eric. Well, actually by the Group of Four, via their puppet on Langhorn's throne, but it amounts to the same thing." Garvai winced at the biting sarcasm of Caleb's last sentence, and the Emperor chuckled harshly.
"If I believed for a moment that Eric actually spoke for God, I'd be worried by that, General. As it is, I take it rather as a badge of honor. As my father once told me, it's true that a man can be known by his friends, but you can tell even more about him by the enemies he makes. However, it would leave you in a rather ticklish position if I were to ask for your parole. In the eyes of the Temple Loyalists, you'd be guilty of trafficking with heretics at the very least. And also in the eyes of the Temple Loyalists, any parole you granted to me would be invalid, since no one can swear any binding oath to someone who's been excommunicated. If you attempted to honor your word, which, by the way, I believe you would, then you would be twice damned in the Temple's eyes." "I will confess," Caleb admitted, "that I was tempted to offer you parole anyway. It would have been one way to help accelerate the fragmentation of Coruscant's internal stability, which could only help my own cause. But after considering it more maturely, I decided that using an honorable foe in that